that behind mind is this heart complex through which the consciousness of a being manifests and becomes the total possessor of body. And as the complete autocrat, then permits the polarization of its own purpose in the brain as the mental focus. Now, it is reasonably obvious that during the processes of life, the brain is active. That this activity has what we have suggested as this kind of round-robin process. This process of the wheel turning. And then we come to the problem of how the mind is associated with the brain. Does the mind impose itself completely on the brain? Does the mind envelop the brain? Does the mind hide itself in certain cells of the brain? Is the mind lurking in the mysterious ventricular openings of the brain? This was the more common thought of the ancient. He held definitely that the most attenuated part of the brain must be the part which links it to the next superior and still more attenuated energy. Therefore, that in all probabilities, there might be within the brain itself no cell, no physical unit, which could be appropriately used as a pole for the mental principle. If, therefore, there is any, the ancients made a rather subtle use of the old story of the tabernacle in the wilderness, in which they divided the wanderer's temple of the Jewish tribes in the wilderness into its three parts, the court, the holy place, and the holy of holies, declaring these three parts to represent, in a sense, the parts of man's body. That within the body itself, within the area of the body, there were two principal rooms. The holy place, which was the body as an instrument, and the holy of holies, which was the cranium, or the skull. And that this was, as the Greeks said, attached to the body by an isthmus called the neck. I think that's a rather nice way of saying it. An isthmus. We all know how it would sound if someone said, well, I have a pain in the isthmus. This, it might also be a good way of putting a certain well-known phrase in case you are having social difficulties. In any event, within the Holy of Holies was the Ark of the Covenant. The Ark of the Covenant consisted of these two cherubs, kneeling upon the surface of a great chest-like box. The cherubs faced each other, and their wings met overhead. And the space beneath their wings was called the mercy seat. And it was here, between the wings of the cherubs, that the Shekinah's glory, or the presence of the Lord, was made manifest. The Shekinah's glory did not appear in the box, nor did it take over either of the cherubs, nor did it have an image of its own, for no image was permitted of it. It appeared in a space between these cherubs, whose meeting wings above resembled very closely the structure of the two hemispheres of the forebrain. Within this space, inside the brain, overshadowed by these two great brain lobes, is a series of ventricles, of which perhaps the most commonly referred to and best known is the third ventricle. It is in this ventricular space also that we find the location of the two great ductless glands of the brain, the pineal and the pituitary body. In the ancient beliefs, Albertus Magnus held this opinion. So did the great artist Leonardo da Vinci. It was the common belief of the great Arab physicians and scholars of older time that in some mysterious way, this ventricular opening, this hollow place, this room, this secret abode of the Most High, this wonderful palace built upon the Palatine Hill, the palate being the upper part of the mouth, that here we have the place where the superior principle, in this case the mental principle, has its closest possible relationship with the body. Now, in order for this relationship to exist, it is inevitable and necessary, therefore, that this ventricular space be not empty, but rather be in a continual state of vibration, that a golden mist, or as was sometimes referred to in the old writings, a kind of dew of heaven, that this actually had to fill this ventricle, and that in this mysterious glow or light, the Shekinah's glory, which in all probabilities is the original of the halo around the head, that in this light field, the next superior part impinged itself upon the brain. And that in this way, it was continually exercising a very subtle influence. And into this area, according to the older beliefs, the sensations poured. And in this area, they were coordinated. Leonardo da Vinci, in one of his wonderful drawings of the cross-section of the human brain, he anticipated Vesalius slightly, but did not carry the point as far as this great anatomist. In one of his drawings, following earlier custom, of course, Leonardo labels the central ventricular orifice of the brain the place of the community of the senses. He calls this, of course, where the senses are in common. And, of course, we preserve the term by saying common sense, that this is the field of the common sense in man. Well, now we all realize that the field is in a sad state of decrepitude at the present moment, but that perhaps something could be done to reclaim it. The common sense, in this case, does not mean judgment that agrees with the masses. Common sense means a place where these various processes meet in some common ground, a coordinating area. And Albertus Magnus and Thomas Aquinas were both of the opinion that it was in this central area, this central ventricular space, that all confusion and discord concerning sensory perception had to be arbitrated, and that out of this arbitration came reasonable opinion, or attitudes that were themselves common sense, or arising from the common testimony of all senses. Now, if we use that definition today, who would claim common sense? Who could say common sense if it meant that it was a common and honest union of the testimony of all senses, opinions, attitudes, beliefs, and desires, that therefore common sense was as near as we can attain to the truth of the matter, because all of the elements of the matter have been honestly estimated and fitted together into their most reasonable pattern. This automatic process is said to go on continuously. But with the possibility of the mental impingement being therefore in the field of this energy, we can say, what kind of energy are we now dealing with? The answer most likely is the field of the nervous energy of the body. For it is into this as into a reservoir that must pour all of the sensations which have been gathered by the nervous system, specialized and put back into semblance of reasonable appearance or reasonable coordination by the brain structure itself, and then dispatched to this central region for interpretation, for classification, and for judgment upon the matter. The brain does not judge. The brain turns it all over to the mysterious oracle that abides in the shadow of the Most High. And therefore, as the priest of the ancient tabernacle rites entered into the Holy of Holies to there ask the will of God in all matters, so we may say that the brain, to achieve the interpretation of sensory testimony which it has assembled, must for this purpose call upon a power superior to itself. And this superior to itself power is present because of the impingement of the mental nature upon this sensitized area, which is a highly specialized electromagnetic field within the brain. If this is assumed out of ancient symbolism to be not an unreasonable conclusion, we may then suspect that there is a reason for the very subtle membrane which is curiously placed in this area, a membrane which could have a function of almost a God ear. Just as the eardrum is responsive to certain vibration, so this mysterious curtain in the third ventricle could very well be the mysterious drum, the mysterious subtle substance by means of which the vibration agitation could be set up. Therefore, that the actual communication is in terms of vibration made possible through the very rapid motion of this drum-like membrane in the field of energy. We are not able to dogmatize these things because science simply has not been able to explore this matter. But it would follow immediately that if this field is composed of this rarefied form of energy distilled from the nerve processes of the body, and therefore carrying in it, as in the air a radio program is carried, the various testimonies set up by sensory perception, it would then, of course, immediately follow that if for any reason this magnetic field of body energy is cut off, that immediately the available energy in this glandular field or in this ventricular field would also be cut off. Under such conditions, this field would suddenly become negative. It would simply no longer be a field of energy. It would become a vacuum. This would immediately cut off the possibility of the mind operating upon these energies, and the mind's relationship to the body and to brain function would be lost. Also, it is quite obvious that at death, all such energy fields would cease as far as the body is concerned. Consequently, the moment these energies ceased, there could no longer be a rational connection between the mind and the brain field. The mind would not necessarily have to depart anywhere any more than it would be necessary for the broadcasting station to move every time we wanted to turn off a program. The power to turn off and on the program rests with the person. But when the vibratory polarities, which make possible the tuning in of the program, are broken or lost, then the program simply ceases to exist, as far as that particular instrument is concerned. As this is a living program, as this is a program of energy in function, it would inevitably follow also that under these circumstances, mental processes could not survive anything which damages the magnetic field in the brain or any process relating to it. What happens if this energy field becomes comparatively free from all impulse impact? Let us assume, for example, what happens in sleep. Here we have a very good example of our problem. In the process of sleep, sensation is no longer actively carried to the brain. The sensory perceptions are either totally ineffective or largely suspended. Consequently, all of the five sensory testimonies upon which we depend for awareness itself, not only awareness of meaning, but awareness of object, these have been suspended, and under normal conditions, the result is the complete suspension of the coordinating power. In sleep, therefore, the mysterious energies in the ventricular orifice are no longer conveying any sensation or any adequate sensation. As a result of that, the brain coordinator is not called into function. The mind is not involved because there is nothing for it to work upon. The result is unconsciousness as we know it. Unconsciousness is therefore, for our physical living, directly associated with the suspension of function. If we suspend the five senses, we are asleep, which means we are unaware of anything. Thus, that which we call brain awareness comes from the outside, not from the inside. For we have no way of assuming or suspecting that mind sleeps. For it is said in the scripture, the God of Israel neither slumbers nor sleeps. And that is the same power that was between the wings of the cherub. What happens, however, is that mind, separated from the pressure of brain stimulus, simply returns to its own native state. And that native state cannot be consciously experienced by the brain. This, then, leads us to the problem of the release of the psychic life from the body, part of which I think we've already clarified in the process of going along, but which we want to try to fit now into a more condensed picture. According to most of the ancient thinkers, and most of our Eastern thinkers also, what we call objective or human physical consciousness awareness is essentially distributed throughout the body and throughout all areas nourished by the nervous system. It therefore means that essentially man's physical body is physically conscious in all its parts. Part of this consciousness, however, is not understandable or acceptable by man, inasmuch as the gamut of human interpretation is limited. And as man ascends the ladder of evolutionary mental specialization, he must leave off one by one the lower rungs. He can no longer share in the consciousness of the primordial atom. He can no longer actually share in the consciousness of the evolving creatures through whose life principles he himself has passed. Because he cannot, again, escape from the actual boundaries of his processes. And man is man. Therefore, his consciousness is involved in the relationship between his brain and a mental energy or a mental being of human estate. Therefore, he cannot escape from this area of consciousness. It would naturally follow, therefore, that man's body might be conscious in all its parts, but man have only a general consciousness of his body. He is aware of it, but he certainly cannot experience any longer the frustrations and neuroses of single cells. They are no longer available to his awareness, but we have no reason to doubt that any cell in the body of man can suffer, because the way we treat the body is enough to be very discouraging even to the best adjusted cell. In any purpose, however, of the moment, the ancients held that in the process of death, energies were not lost, but that the energies of the body slowly moved backward along the nerve threads. And as the nerve threads lost their energization and all the processes of circulation ceased, the first parts of the body to disintegrate would be the extremities, or those areas furthest from the life center. Finally, all of these energies would converge toward the heart. And in the heart, they would build themselves a kind of sanctuary in what the old Buddhist councils called the Saptapana cavern, or the cave of seven rooms, which is the heart. After the coordination of these processes within the heart structure itself, the processes of death then consisted of the motion of the heart center, which in this case represents the polar focus of the conscious being itself. That this heart center then moved up the pneumogastric nerve into the brain. And that in the brain, it then gathered up all of the energies and resources of the mental life, continuing on its journey, passing out at the rear top of the skull into the atmosphere of space from which it came. And researchers have indicated that the body may show warmth at the crown of the head after it is not to be found elsewhere. And of course, the tonsure, or the shaving of the head, the mysterious ornaments and decorations worn by priests of antiquity, the ornaments and symbols associated with death, as for example, down in our own Southwest, the placing of an inverted bowl over the head at the time of burial, but always with a small hole knocked in the bottom of the bowl so that the soul could escape. These symbols seem to go back to archetypal convictions. Once the body has proven that it can no longer sustain the consciousness or is no longer able to function adequately, the processes of deterioration in the body close in upon the functioning of these areas or fields. And as a result, these fields cease to animate. And as soon as the energy in these fields ceases, the superphysical principle can no longer retain relationship with the body to which it was previously connected. Therefore, it is actually the body that closes the door. It is the body which no longer provides these fields or these areas. And the principles operating on the body or through the body or in the body gather themselves into their own sources and gradually depart. In departing, we simply mean that they cease to have conscious connection with the body. The body is then no longer theirs. It no longer is aware of them. And in only by interior imagery is it or the consciousness aware of the body. Although there appears to be some evidence of temporary sympathetic relationships between the magnetic fields and the body. These relationships, however, are normally very brief. The failure of these fields has simply made it impossible for the superior nature, so to say, to continue to impinge upon the body. Therefore, the body is no longer a channel for its energies. and as its own energies are not adequate to maintain it, the body then disintegrates. This means, of course, that in the old philosophies, that the problem of the state of the consciousness apart from the body was of supreme symbolic importance. Knowing that such severance must occur, we remember how Buddha in the Dhammapada, or the last great discourse, describes the situation of his own decease, how he achieved the liberation of the superior from the inferior by a conscious process of meditation, that he quietly, gently, and wisely led the mind and the superior parts of the nature out of the body when the body had become so sickened that it was no longer able to support him. He therefore, to a measure, quietly, voluntarily, achieved the processes of death by intention, and in this way, quietly departed from the body. In his departure from the body, he indicated his knowledge of the great Yoga Chakra concept of ancient India, the power to control and direct the various fields of energy and to make possible various stages of specialized relationship between the body, the mind, and the being behind the mind. In the light of our discussion last week, I think we shall then be implying that the relationship of this twofold evolutionary process is involved also in this situation. Bodies, through the processes of growth being the achieved refinement of bodies through the experiencing by reflex of the achievements of the mind inhabiting them. The mind leading the body can imply for that body an increasing participation in good. It can counsel the moderation of all practices. It can search into the secrets of health. It can also gradually overcome the principal enemies of the body, which are not physical circumstances but psychic stress. Thus, the body, in the service of the enlightened mind, becomes itself permeated with higher and higher vibratory nerve energy rates, and these gradually result in the increasing refinement of the body. And as the body is composed of substances, the continual evolution of substance is attained by its continual incorporation into structures dominated by superior intelligence. Thus, the evolution of substance is attained by it being built into bodies and coming into continuous contact with higher forms of mentation, just in the same way that the lower animal kingdoms, through constant association with man, have in some cases become domesticated, and in some cases, again, highly intelligent, highly sensitive, and apparently very little less than man in their capacity to sense, understand, appreciate, and value. Thus, by association, things become better or worse according to that with which they associate. And bodies associating with mind and vitalized by consciousness have their own cellular structures energized. Their own atoms vibrate more rapidly. And in this way, the entire mass of substance is gradually refined and therefore capable of providing ever more adequate vehicles or ever better bodies, in the sense that these bodies are more sensitive. Now, the more sensitive the body, the greater the demands upon the regulation of that body. For it is obvious that a more sensitive body, like a more highly bred animal, will be subject to more infirmities, cannot be as easily abused, cannot be neglected without the gravest results. Primitive bodies can stand much abuse. The highly civilized person cannot. There are cases of warriors in North Africa who have walked 15 miles with a bullet in their hearts. They did not even drop in their tracks. No ordinary Western person could accomplish this phenomenon due to the much greater psychic and structural sensitivity of our bodies. This means, of course, that the body is more easily sickened, that the relations between mind and body become more subtle, that there is ever greater danger of psychological, emotional, and mental disease where the principles and laws governing the balance and interrelationship of parts are broken or neglected. Thus, the body in its refinement becomes something that must be watched and guarded with increasing caution. For a body of lower organic quality may recover from psychic hurt in a few hours or feel practically no pain, whereas another person with the same psychic hurt may be damaged for the rest of their lives. This increasing sensitivity is part of the evolution of matter or substance itself, which is merely, in reality, a lesser degree of energy or a less evolved degree of energy, which must in turn evolve also, so that the smallest cell in the body becomes the potential universe of the infinite future. In thus depending upon man or the total being for the evolution of their own parts, structures contribute their own part to the manifestation of the total being. This total being is held together archetypally by the pattern of species, the archetype of man being the celebrated Adam Kadmon of the ancient Kabbalistic mysteries. There is, however, a mental archetypal being or person, and there is one of still higher nature. But this evolutionary process from brain, which is the most particular, to mind, which is the most analytical, then goes on beyond this to the mysterious X, which we like to refer to as consciousness, but which we must never confuse with the personal consciousness arising in our brain-mind chemistry. This other consciousness, this consciousness of the other side of existence, referred to in Buddhism as the consciousness of the far shore of life. This we are not able to adequately define. There seems to be no area in our own psychoglandular structure that can tune this in. The only possibility, therefore, lies in the situation of the relationship of mind with its own superior. There is no consolation in the relationship between mind and its inferior, the body. If mind can be completely cleared of body as a psychic pressure, the ancients then believed that the mind's function would be suspended to the degree that the primary impulse of consciousness would become discernible. This would be equivalent to the Tao of Lao Tzu. Tao being the universal motion. Lao Tzu believed motion to be true consciousness, and that the universal motion is a qualitative motion of life from itself to itself. Therefore, that involutionary consciousness is life seeking the expression of itself. Evolutionary consciousness is life seeking the rediscovery of unity with its own cause. And that consequently, if consciousness has any quality about it, it is a hunger for the complete expression of its own nature. That the end of consciousness is to draw everything back into its own totality, and in so doing, to expand its own totality over all things. This is the double process, the process of nature growing up toward totality and totality moving into nature, producing the two mysterious interlocked figures of the yang and the yin in Chinese symbolism. So these two striving end finally in the re-identification of the consciousness factor per se. What this is, no one has yet been able to define adequately, because it is a consciousness not of this world, or pertaining to conditions in this world, or to the state of man's soul while he is in this world, or to any good or evil that may befall him in this world. The true nature of consciousness, apparently, is a situation or a condition of total awareness of total self. This is not possible during the conditioned existence in which we live. I would feel that in the next 10 years, science might make some very helpful and perhaps positive discoveries. If they would approach certain matters, perhaps first by faculties they least desire to use, and to realize, for example, that in matters pertaining to true mind, science as we know it is inadequate. Science is the science of the brain. Philosophy is the science of the mind. Religion is the science of consciousness. These things have to be approached on their own levels, and there is no possible way of moving the lower up to become the critic of the higher. Our next immediate problem in the growth of the average human being is further knowledge and further understanding of the relation of the mental coordinator to brain function. To achieve this knowledge, it seems to me that we have to apply to reason. That we are going to find this knowledge in areas of psychological folklore. We're going to find this record not in cell structure. We are going to find it primarily in the products of the mentation process itself. In other words, our study of thinking must involve a research into thought itself, particularly into the products of primordial thought, or the products of such types of thought as are of the purest and least adulterated kind, thoughts in which the brain factor is the least emphasized. Perhaps, therefore, we would find much more of this process of true study of mind if we studied the very young, in whose processes confusion has not yet generally entered. We may also come upon very valuable information if we will begin to realize the importance of analogy, the recognition that we can estimate certain unseen procedures by a further study of certain manifestations of these procedures which can be seen. But if we deny the possibility of a mental entity, we are going to destroy the possibility of discovering the mental fact. Our principal stumbling block has been the reluctance of the Western thinker to assume that intelligence can exist apart from matter. It has to, because actually intelligence in free space has always controlled matter. And it is also possible that what we call matter is no more nor less than a negative condition of intelligence. It is therefore impossible for us to assume that intelligence is limited to the brain. We can study enough microorganisms to know now that there are indications of definite intelligence in forms in nature in which no brain structure can be discovered. Therefore, while certain types of highly specialized intelligence require brain, there is no proof that mind and brain must be considered identical, or that mind must perish with brain, or that mind is generated with the physical development of brain. This is the big stumbling block today. And unless we get past that, we are never going to find the real solutions to how and why we think. We are going to then ultimately be forced to the recognition that what we call the pure energy of mind, while it exists, is not essentially physical. It clothes itself in physical nerve energy. But this other energy is not identical with nerve energy. Even as the wire of the telephone is not identical with the electricity that goes across it or through it. Thus, in our search, we must recognize that the mental energy is contributed to the brain, and that also it can in turn deprive the brain of its existence by taking itself away from the brain. That the mind is in almost certainly is in a condition to exist without the brain, but the brain is not an a condition to exist without the mind. The inferior must always depend upon the superior. But that which is superior can never be completely held, bound, or dominated by an inferior. Therefore, if the mind is superior to the brain, it is not subject to the law of the brain, nor is it subject to death with the brain. But having its own existence, it can have a free life in space, where, as a mental entity, it can continue its evolution, continue its growth, and in time re-overshadow or come again into embodiment. And what we call ourselves, Joe Smith and Joe Doakes, we are really this mental energy vortex, growing up under the testimony and instruction of the sensory reflexes, and naturally obligated to continue this instruction so long as the material sphere is instructive to us. But having reached a point, a condition, in which this material sphere is no longer instructive, we must either assume that the man who knows everything simply drops dead, or else we must assume that the man who knows everything takes his knowledge and goes other places where he can learn, if possible, on another level where he has not learned everything that there is to know. It is therefore quite reasonable to assume that that which is gathering information has a reason, and that the tremendous processes of nature are not so organized that man will store away in his brain the experiences of a lifetime and then lose all of this as a result of a stroke, or that he will put away carefully all this valuable information, regularly and properly filed, and then depart into nothingness, so that the brain, with all the records, fall into one grand and glorious decay. This cannot be regarded as essential. But we have this point. Assuming that the mind does carry these records, is the record of what it does here invaluable to the mind that is not here? I think it is, for this reason. If the mind, departing from here, departed from here to everywhere in one step, then the chances are that this information so carefully garnered would be of no value. But if this mind, having a vast curriculum to achieve, a mind in which there must be periodic re-embodiments in order to attain its ultimate supremacy over the laws and phenomena of the objective universe, if such is the natural plan, and it seems to be, or else there would be no reason for creation whatsoever. If this is true, that there is a reason, then the possession of mentally remembered facts would become of the greatest validity in assisting the individual in the direction of future conduct when he has again attained a brain. Now, it is also perfectly possible that when he attains this brain and permeates it with his own mental energy, that this brain will then, to a large measure, be vitalized and will become the continuing function of his own mental purpose. There is only one catch in this, and that is that when he comes to find a new brain, he must find a brain suitable to the degree of evolution which he has attained. If this is not achieved, then, of course, naturally and obviously, he cannot make maximum use of his problem, of his achievement. It being known that brain must grow and that gradually mind must take hold of brain in order to bring it finally into coordination with its own purposes, we then have every evidence that it is only after a number of years, years which we now say precede the period of maturity or adulthood or majority, that until this time has been reached, the mind carrying its own purposes has not yet completely become accustomed to a brain, achieved a rapport with it that is satisfactory, and is able then to continue the growth where it left off. Up to this time, the new inhabitant of the brain, not being adjusted, the control and direction of that brain must still be parental or social. And the individual is not regarded as self-responsible until the mind has become comfortably oriented in the brain, capable of using it, and capable of directing the flow of mental energy through the nervous system. These facts present, perhaps, the only solution that can explain purposefully a series of mysterious circumstances with which, without purpose, are amoral, completely meritless, and condemn the individual to a purposeless existence. Man rejects this because he cannot live with it. And in the course of years, the next step, I feel certain, is the final recognition of men of science and of learning that this mental thing which we call ourselves is capable of independent existence, has existed before and will exist again, and that what we call life is merely an incident in a great curriculum of educational awareness by means of which mind conquers matter, and by so doing restores matter to identity with itself. And matter, gradually refining, finally becomes identical with mind. And by this process, as the ancient mythologies tell us, the entire level of function is raised from a level of matter to a level of mind. When this is achieved, of course, the next step will be the gradual absorption of mind into the substance of consciousness. These processes continue. Where they begin, our consciousness, as we have it today, cannot tell us. Where it will end, we have no way of knowing. But unless we recognize a valid and rational plan, we will never have the social, ethical, moral incentives to improve our world. And we will never understand evolution as a means of advancing the total good of humanity. Time's up.